So I guess this course is called Quantum Field Theory 3. And I'll be lecturing you for the next couple of weeks. So my name is Jaume Gomis. I'm a faculty member here, PI, if you don't know me. And my office number is 427. If you want to come to talk to me or ask me questions and so on. I encourage you to ask questions during the lecture, before or after the lecture. So I don't mind at all being interrupted. So in the next couple of weeks, I'll be introducing you to a subject which is called conformal field theory, which may sound very technical, but one of the nice things about this subject is that it is at the intersection of many areas in theoretical physics. And perhaps more importantly, at least conceptually, is at the heart of the way we think about quantum field theory in general. And quantum field theory in itself is kind of central to physics. It's relevant for condensed matter, for particle physics, for cosmology, for statistical mechanics, and so on. So in today's lecture, which is going to be kind of more of an introduction, I will just give you a bird's eye view of why conformal field theories and some of the areas where it enters and why it's important, and introduce some characters that we will develop in the next 2 weeks in detail. So today, the point is just to kind of whet your appetite of what the subject is and why it's important, and then we will develop all the buzzwords that will appear. We will study them in detail as we go along. Okay, so what's the subject? So this is conformal field theory. So you usually use the acronym CFT, so do not keep saying the same thing all over and over again. So the word that, so the last two words that you're familiar with, you've been tortured for the last, I don't know, few months over this. So the word that we'll have to focus on is the word conformal, and we will develop it as we go along, okay? So what is a conformal field theory? So in a sense, it's something simple. It's just it is a quantum field theory. So what is this? So this is a quantum field theory of the type that you've been studying, which has additional extra space-time symmetries. So here, there are two words I want to focus on that are important. Well, quantum field theory, you know something about. And the thing I want to focus on that will be at the core of why conformal field theories are special and important, there are two words. One is the word symmetries. So you're familiar with the concept of symmetries even when you studied undergraduate. And obviously, symmetries play an important role in solving physical systems. For example, if you study just a point particle moving in a potential, which is time independent, you know, if you solve Newton's equations, you have to solve a second order differential equation, right? But if the potential is time independent, energy is conserved. And then you can use the fact that you have extra symmetries, namely time translational invariance, to use that to reduce the problem from a second order differential equation to a first order differential equation. Okay, so even in classical mechanics, symmetries are very powerful. They allow us to constrain the dynamics. All the more so in quantum physics. And you may have seen already hints of that in your courses. So these are quantum field theories that have additional symmetries. So that's good. More symmetries means more constraints and maybe more likely that we can solve the theory. You know, in general, quantum field theories we don't know how to solve at all, right? We can, unless they're free field theories, in which case I consider them boring, you can solve those. You can compute everything you want there. But in general, quantum field theories you cannot solve. You may be able to do something in perturbation theory, but that's not really a solution of the problem. You can compute quantities in some expansion, but you don't know an exact solution of the theory. So if you study theories with symmetries, you may be able to solve the theory and study the properties of the theory in regimes where perturbation theory wouldn't allow you to go, like when the theory is strongly coupled, if you have an expansion parameter. So that's why even just as a test case of studying theories that you may be able, quantum field theories that you may be able want to, that you may want to solve, you want to study theories of as many symmetries as possible. But the symmetry that we're discussing is very special. It's a space-time symmetry. This is to be contrasted with internal global symmetries that you may have encountered. So a space-time symmetry, by definition, is a symmetry that is implemented by a transformation that acts on space-time, in the space-time that we live. And this is to be constructed, for example, with an internal symmetry. Like, for example, you have n real scalars. You can have an On symmetry that rotates the n scalars into each other. That's an internal symmetry, that's not a space-time symmetry because it doesn't touch the space-time points. It acts the same at all space-time points. Okay. Okay, good. So can you give me two examples of space-time symmetries that you have encountered in your life before talking about conformal field theory? Okay. Yeah, more generally, Poincaré symmetry. So relativistic quantum field theories, essentially by definition, are theories that are invariant under the Poincaré symmetry. Okay, so you have Poincaré. So this would be essentially a quantum field theory, in some sense, is a theory that invariant under the Poincaré symmetry. More precisely, it's invariant under the translations and what's called the connect component of the Lorentz group. Okay, you know, the Poincaré is, the Poincaré group has different components. Some of them are discrete, like parity and time reversal. And theories may or may not be invariant under those discrete transformations, but they have to be invariant under the connect component. Do you know another example of a space-time symmetry that some field theories have in the non-relativistic world?
Galilean?
Yeah, Galilean. So you can have Poincaré or Galilean. So this would be like in relativistic quantum field theory. This would be in non-relativistic quantum field theory. So essentially, a conformal field theory is one of these theories that you know and love that has additional symmetries, additional space-time symmetries. Okay. And as I said, since symmetries are powerful, if the theory has additional space-time symmetries, we'll be able to tell more, we'll be able to constrain more the dynamics of the theory because the theory has more symmetries. Okay. Good. So I'll just make a comment of why stop at conformal. There might be other more fancy space-time symmetries that one could define that would further constrain the dynamics of a quantum field theory. And now I'll just quote you a theorem that obviously I will not prove, but just to give you a context of why conformal field theories are, in a sense, important and unique, is that conformal symmetry, which is the symmetry that a conformal field theory has, just like relativistic quantum field theory has Poincaré symmetry, a conformal field theory has conformal symmetry as the symmetry transformations. Conformal symmetry is the largest symmetry group that non-trivial QFT can have. Okay, and by non-trivial I mean the following. I mean a theory that is not free field theory. So if you try to construct a theory that has more space-time symmetries than conformal symmetries, you can essentially prove that that theory is a free field theory. And free field theories, since we can solve everything about them, they're not interesting from that point of view. And the smallest one that you can impose on a theory and still have non-trivial dynamics, namely not those of a free field theory, is exactly conformal symmetry. So that's why conformal symmetry is very special. It's the largest symmetry that a theory can have while still being interesting, from the point of view of not being a free field theory. Okay, here I'm lying slightly a bit, so let me just make a small parenthesis. This statement has a generalization. So you know that in quantum field theory, global symmetries are implemented by conserved charges. If the conserved charges of your symmetry if you have a theory that has conserved charges that have a spin a half, so they're like spinners. Then conformal symmetry gets enhanced to what's called superconformal symmetry. And that's still within non-trivial. I'm just saying it just to be complete. And that's essentially a theory that has what you must have heard, supersymmetry. So if you can have a theory that has supersymmetry and conformal symmetry. When you combine those two together, you have superconformal symmetry. And this is really the largest symmetry group that a non-trivial QFT can have. So you see that conformal symmetry already plays a very special role in the kind of in the space of all quantum field theories. Okay. So I still haven't defined what conformal is. So I will start with something that you all have an intuition about. Yes.
When you talk about enhancing the conformal symmetry by some degrees of freedom, is that not just adding an internal symmetry?
No, because it's not internal, because the supercharges act on space-time. Actually, more generally, in supersymmetry, it's a very funny thing. So you have like Minkowski space. In supersymmetry, you have what's called superspace. So you have your four-dimensional Minkowski space, and then you have some funny quantum dimensions that are parameterized by Grassmann coordinates. And supersymmetry acts on the whole enchilada. Yeah. Okay, so. You know, a conformal field theory or superconformal field theory may have extra global symmetries like the standard ones, like flavor symmetries and so on. Okay. So I'm just talking about the space-time symmetries. There is no constraint. There is no constraint on the global symmetries, the non-space-time symmetries that the quantum field theory can have in general. I mean, you can take a gazillion real scalars, you have a gazillion, all gazillion symmetry. Okay, so what is a conformal transformation? So you have intuition about Poincaré and Galilean transformations. So now let's talk about the. We're going to talk about conformal transformations. So these are. I'm going to start with the one. So we will derive what is the set. So tomorrow, whenever, I think it's Thursday, we will derive all the conformal transformations from first principles, just the way you can derive Poincaré transformations by asking what is the most general set of transformations that preserve the Lorentz metric. We will classify all the possible conformal transformations allowed in Minkowski space. But there is one, so let me introduce one that you already have an intuition is, which is a scale transformation. So this is a transformation that essentially allows you to zoom in and out in a given space-time region. It allows you to study to scale things at different length scales, okay? So in general, this transformation will look like it will map the space-time coordinates this way, the space coordinates this way, and in general, the time coordinate this way, okay? So that's a scale transformation. And essentially, it just asks, when you implement a scale transformation, you're zooming in or zooming out of the system. So you're probing the system at different length scales, okay? Now, this Z, it's called a critical dynamical exponent. And actually, that's inherently a property of the scale transformation. So can someone tell me what do you think the value of Z would be for a theory that's scale invariant and has Poincaré symmetry? Okay, someone guess something, even if it's just a wild.
One.
Yeah, because in a Lorentz invariance theory, space and time are kind of brothers in arms, so they better scale the same way. So Z equals one in a relativistic but for example, in a non-relativistic system, Z can have other values. For example, if you look at the Schrodinger equation, convince yourself that in the Schrodinger equation, Z equals two in the free Schrodinger equation. Okay. Good. So maybe I should stop for a second to make, so today is kind of, I make different points that hopefully complement things that you may have seen, but hopefully also add from a different perspective. So without thinking about it, when we do physics, we always have in mind this notion of scale transformation, of a scale, of an energy scale. So whenever you study a physical system, you have to, you implicitly or explicitly have in mind some length scale that you're studying the system at. So for example, if you study water, your description of the system will depend on what length scale you study the system. For example, if you study at macroscopic distances, you'll be able to get away with studying water using kind of hydrodynamics, because the length scale that you probe are much larger than the length scale of, say, the molecules that water is made of. But now imagine you zoom in. Then at some point, you're going to start seeing that the water is made of molecules. And then your description of the system will have to be a different one, because you have a more fine-grained description of the system. And you can continue going on and on like that. So you can now zoom in even deeper. And now you will see that, the molecules are made of atoms, and the atom is made out of the proton. Okay. So then at some point, your hydrodynamic description, your description in terms of non-relativistic quantum mechanics is no longer valid. And you have to study, for example, quantum chromodynamics, because that's the theory that governs the properties of the nucleus. And then if you go deeper, well, so the proton is made out of quarks and gluons, and then you have to use that description. If we went further, actually, we don't know whether if the quarks and the gluons are fundamental. There are theories that posit that they're not fundamental. And then if you went even further, you would have to change your description again, because you went to a length scale which is no longer appropriate for the higher length scale. Okay. And that's how physics works. It's a bit like an onion. And depending on what length scale you use, you have to use a different description. Now, luckily for humanity, in order to understand water, we don't need to understand quantum gravity, which would be the theory of the shortest distance scales, because then we wouldn't make any progress, because we don't really know what quantum gravity is. But in the last 2,000 years, we've made progress. And the point is that, as I will quantify in more detail later, in order to describe a physical system at a given length scale or a scale, you don't need to know everything about arbitrary short distances. Okay, you only need to know a little bit about symmetries, and then you know a little bit about the symmetries and your degrees of freedom. You can give an accurate description of low energy physics without knowing everything at arbitrary short distances. Okay, and we will see this in a more quantitative way this manner. So definitely, scale transformations is something that we know and we are familiar with, and even when we don't think about it, we always study the system at a given length scale. When we say, okay, this is the Lagrangian of my system, you have in mind that you're probing at some length scale, okay? Good. More generally, so this is a one that you are familiar with. There will be other transformations apart from a scale transformation that we will have to study. The other ones are not so intuitive, so I will not try to explain them now. We will study them next time, if we ever get there. But let me just kind of define for now what a conformal transformation is more generally. So this is a space-time transformation. So now, from now on, I'm going to forget about, for most of this, okay, for essentially all of the course, we will study Poincaré invariant conformal field theories and not discuss so much Galilean invariant ones. So from now on, I will use the usual relativistic notation to unite space and time, okay? So a conformal transformation is a space-time transformation that maps x mu to x tilde of mu of x that has the property that it preserves angles. So if you take the usual Minkowski metric in flat space and you implement a scale transformation, you preserve the line element up to a scale factor. Okay. Now, if we're doing Poincaré transformations, the definition of a Poincaré transformation is a transformation of this type for which this is one, right? Poincaré transformations preserve the line element. Conformal transformations preserve the line element up to an overall scale. As it's an overall scale, angles drop out. So if the angles are not changed, but the scale may be changed. Okay. And in the next lecture, we're going to completely solve this problem. this is a problem that can completely be solved. You write down the most general transformation X tilde, and you can there's a finite set of transformations that have this property. Okay. And in particular, if we do the scale transformation where X mu goes to lambda X mu, then obviously the line element changes like this. That's why this allows us, by tuning lambda, you can zoom in and zoom out. Okay, so now let's try to study examples of conformal field theories. So since these are systems, so since the conformal field theory is a system that looks the same at all length scales, because what I'm saying is that this is a symmetry. So in general, you know, if we zoom out in this room in and out, you know, the system doesn't look the same at different length scales. But there are systems that look the same at all length scales. So a system, in order for a system not to look the same as a length scale, a necessary condition is that the system does not have an intrinsic length scale. If it had a length scale, it couldn't possibly look the same at all length scales. So can you give me examples of theories that you know that have no length scales in them? Like quantum field theories that you've studied that have no length scales in them. Sorry? Free Maxwell, yeah, so that's one. Other ones?
Massless scalar field, or it does
have one? No, massless, but can you make it more interesting than just massless scalar field is a free theory. Sorry?
5-4?
Yeah, 5-4 theory. So I'm just writing the equations of motion of the 5 to the 4 theory. Oh, and this is important, this is in 4 dimensions. Another one?
Verticalizing.
Yeah, that's a very fancy one, yes, okay. The problem is that with that one, we don't have a Lagrangian description of that. It's a strongly coupled, yeah, so this, we will discuss the Isaac model to almost death, but the point is that this is not a theory that you can, that it's a non-trivial conformal field theory, so it's not something that you can honestly write a Lagrangian for. It's a strongly coupled theory. In a certain sense, it's a theory that you can read from a Lagrangian description by making the coupling constant very large, where we don't know what we're doing, essentially, but perturbation theory breaks down. So thinking about it in this way is not very useful. So we'll think about the critical Isaac model in a purely intrinsic way. We'll say that there's a CFT that describes the Isaac model, and there is some set of principles by pure thought, essentially, without ever worrying about Lagrangians. We will solve in quotes, the Isaac model without ever writing a Lagrangian. Just by using the constraints, precisely of these things I was rambling about, we will use the constraints of conformal symmetry to kind of solve for the theory. But yeah, of course, the Isaac model is an example. So this was an example of a theory that propagates a spin 1 degree of freedom. This propagates a spin 0 degree of freedom. Who is missing here? Massless Dirac. So, and also Young-Mills, which I believe you have studied, is also an example. So all these are examples of theories that are scale invariant. At least classically. Now, but what happens quantum mechanically? A theory can be scale invariant classically, but fail to be so quantum mechanically. Okay, and I believe this is something that you already know from studying these quantum field theories, the interacting ones. I mean, this one is always scale invariant because Maxwell theory has no interactions, right? Unless you couple charged matter, right? But for example, this theory or this theory. Are not scale invariant quantum mechanically. And the reason that they're not quantum mechanical is it has to do essentially with quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics tells you that, you know, you have to sum over all possible things that can happen. And that, for example, you must have seen Feynman diagrams like this. That essentially give the coupling constants of quantum field theory a dependence on an energy scale. So this quantum effects essentially imply that, for example, if here you have lambda, this lambda of lambda phi to the 4, lambda now depends on the energy scale. Okay? So that means that the theory is no longer a scale invariant. Okay. Good. So you can have a situation in which you have a theory that has a classical symmetry, but quantum effects violate that symmetry. Okay. And that's essentially what happens with most of these theories. Okay. So most of these theories, as I've written down, except this one, are classically conformal invariant, but not quantum mechanically conformal invariant. Okay. And then the details of the theory depend very strongly on whether the coupling constants becomes large at small scales or large scales. Okay. And this is governed by the beta function of the theory, of that coupling constant. So, so for example, here the point is that the beta function, so dd mu, the logarithmic derivative of the coupling constant, which is by definition what we call the beta function, right, is non-zero. And that's the statement that the theory is quantum mechanically not scale invariant. Okay? And that means that depending on the sign of beta, the theory will be strongly coupled in the ultraviolet, if the beta function is positive, or in the infrared if the beta function is negative. Okay. And the properties of these are you can think of this in the following way. So imagine you have a theory, and now you add to the theory this operator. Okay. So let's be in these space-time dimensions, lambda is a coupling constant, and O is some operator. Okay. For example, in this example, O could be phi to the 4 theory. I start with the free theory, I deform the theory with the lambda phi to the 4 term, and I want to ask what happens at large distances. Okay? And what happens at large distances will depend on a very important property. Is that me? Sorry. It depends on very, very importantly on a property of the operator O that we will study to death, which is called the scaling dimension. The dimension of the operator. Okay, so we want to ask now what happens if I start, say, with a free field theory. Infrared, I always mean low energies. Okay. And this depends on the behavior of O, essentially on the scaling dimension of O. So depends on actually, delta is essentially the eigenvalue. So you know how if you have an operator in a quantum field theory, it transforms in some particular way under Poincaré transformations? The scaling dimension delta is essentially the eigenvalue of the operator under precisely scale transformations. Okay? So operators all carry a given charge under scale transformations, and the charge under scale transformation is precisely the scaling dimension. So now, essentially, there are three things that can happen when you study. So imagine you study here, I want to study this theory, and ask what happens in the infrared. So I have a free field theory, just for simplicity, and I deform by an operator like this. If the dimension delta is bigger than d, we say that the operator O is irrelevant. I believe you have heard these words before, right? Yes? So why do we call the operator O irrelevant? It sounds like a pejorative name, actually. The reason it's irrelevant is technically for a reason, is that it is unimportant in the infrared. That's precisely what it means, and I think you have an intuition by dimensional analysis why an irrelevant operator is unimportant at low energies. Then you can have the operator can have scaling dimension as, oh, sorry, so this D, I mean the space-time dimension. Then we call this operator is relevant. And this is now important in the infrared. And then can, something very special can happen if the dimension delta, if the scaling dimension of the operator O is precisely the space-time dimension D, then we call this O is marginal. Okay. Good. Now, so imagine I give you the lambda phi to the fourth theory. And you write down all operators that you can write down. I think you know how to write down all operators you can write down. And since we're deforming the Lagrangian by it, we want to deform the Lagrangian by something that preserves Poincaré symmetry. So we're going to construct all possible Lorentz scalars out of a scalar field. If you had to put them in baskets, most of the operators are either relevant, irrelevant, or marginal. Irrelevant. Sorry?
Irrelevant.
Irrelevant, yeah. And that's very good. That's very good for the point I'm going to make now. So that means that, for example, if you are a low-energy person, you don't have to worry about the operator phi to the 100, because the effects of the phi to 100 interaction are very, very, very small at very low energies. Okay? So the fact that most operators in a given quantum field theory are irrelevant is essentially why we, going back to this blah, 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 I told you about why don't we need to know things at short distances, comes to fruition. The point is that if you know something about the degrees of freedom at low energies, what you have to do is you write down the most general thing that you can write down giving those degrees of freedom. And so you write down all possible operators that you can construct with those degrees of freedom. And then the point is that even though you have, in general, an infinite number of irrelevant operators, these are essentially not important at low energies. They have a minute effect. And therefore, you will immediately arrive at theories that are written down, given your degrees of freedom, by a collection of relevant and marginal operators, which are always very small. Okay. So even if you don't know anything about quantum gravity, which to leading approximation is a correct statement, we are still able to make experiments and make predictions for water, QCD, and so on, because whatever is happening at very short distances only affects very, very tinily at low energies. That's the decoupling of short distances from long distances. Now, of course, this ignorance of very short distances comes at a price. So when we say that we have a lambda phi to the fourth theory, we have a parameter here, lambda, right? And this parameter is not something we can calculate from first principles. So essentially, the price that you have to pay, which is very small, in fact, for not knowing the theory at arbitrary short distances, is that in order to fully specify the theory, the prediction of the theory, you have to fix the value of lambda at a given energy scale comparing with the experiment. Okay? So once you've done that, then you have ubiquitous predictions for what the theory is. Now, there are more ambitious theories like string theory, where, in a sense, all parameters are completely fixed. So there are no free parameters to fix with. The theory predicts its own coupling constant, so to speak. I am embellishing a little bit, but that's roughly a correct statement. Okay. So the two points I want to make here is the following, is that the fact that only at low energies, only the relevant operators matter is why we can make progress in physics without knowing the theory at arbitrary short distances. If we went to arbitrary short distances, then irrelevant operators would start becoming important, and then essentially you would need to know the whole theory, and that's why quantum gravity is difficult. Okay, so that's one point I wanted to make. Okay, so now I want to, for a few minutes, I want to describe why do we care about conformal field theories. Okay? So I'll give you, there are many answers to this, I'll give you just a few ones, okay? So the first one is the asymptotic low energy behavior of a quantum field theory, arbitrary quantum field theory, massive, is I'm going to say it this way. Oh, by the way, one thing I forgot to mention is that, so I've been told that in the wiki there are some nodes that have been floating around for years. I don't vouch for the validity of all the formulas there, but to leading order, I think it's correct. Sometimes there will be more details that I have time to give in the lecture that you can find there. Is it in the Psi Wiki? I was told that they are? Okay. It's a scale invariant quantum field theory. And the intuition for that is very clear. So if you have a theory that has a certain length scale, if you go at distance much larger than the length scale, there's essentially no length scale left anymore. And now it could happen two things, that the scale invariant theory is trivial. So there are two possibilities. One, it's trivial, which means empty. Essentially, in a sense, all particles in the system were massive. And when you go at energies much lower than anyone else, nothing is left. And then we call it trivial or empty. I should make a small remark here that even though it's trivial from this point of view, these theories are very interesting and play an important role in what's called topological physics of matter. These are systems that are gapped and, in a sense, have no local excitations, but can have so if you study the theory in interesting manifolds, they can have interesting properties. Okay, such theories are not described by a conformal field theory; they're described by what's called a topological quantum field theory. And I should mention that even very mundane theories like quantum chromodynamics in 2+1 dimensions, if you ask what is the physics that emerges at very long distances, you can get things like this. So you start with a theory of quarks and gluons at short distances, and at large distances, you will discover that the low energy description is described by a particular topological quantum field theory. Now, particle physicists, until recently, considered this boring because it has no local correlation functions, but it has non-trivial topology. Okay. So we could do a course about this, but that would be a different course. And the other thing that can happen is that you have a non-trivial conformal field theory. Okay. So that means that when you go to arbitrary large distances, you have a collection of emergent massless degrees of freedom that interact with each other in a scale invariant way. Okay. And these are the theories that we will want to study. So the point is that if you study with an arbitrary massive theory, you're essentially, and you ask the question, what is the asymptotic behavior at low energies? You're always gonna end up with a conformal field theory. Either a non-trivial one or a trivial one, trivial in this sense. I'm gonna call this trivial versus non-trivial, okay? Relatedly, any massive quantum field theory can be thought of as a deformation of a conformal field theory. You can think of this in this way. So this is a massive theory, right? Lambda phi to the 4 is a massive theory. It has a beta function, but can be thought of as a perturbation by a relevant operator of a conformal field theory, which in this case is a pretty boring conformal field theory, which is just the free field theories are conformal invariant if they're massless, okay? So essentially, any massive quantum field theory is a deformation of a quantum field theory. It's the endpoint of any massive quantum field theory. And therefore, there are kind of a special points in the, in the space of all quantum field theories that tell us something about the asymptotic behavior of quantum field theory. Good. So these guys play a special role in the space of quantum field theories, as I explained, and are related to the massive ones by deformations. Now, typically, if you start with a quantum field theory and you deform by a relevant operator, so when you start with a theory and you deform by a relevant operator, so a relevant operator, as I said before, is one whose dimension is smaller than d. And essentially what happens is that the coupling constant associated to the relevant operator grows in the infrared, right? So it becomes strong in the infrared. So that means that our usual tools to study quantum field theory that you studied in the last courses, which is perturbation theory, doesn't work. Because the coupling constant becomes large, quantum fluctuations are large, so perturbation theory is an invalid approximation. So then it is important to ask the following question. So and that's why answering what happens, say, to QCD, which has is an example of this situation where you have a theory where the coupling constant becomes large in the infrared. That's why answering what happens to QCD at large distances is very hard, because we don't have perturbation theory. We can use perturbation theory to study very short distances, but not large distances. And typically what happens is quantum mechanics is kind of wild and crazy. Even though you started in the ultraviolet with something that you know very well, which are quarks and gluons, by the time you go to the infrared, you can get some crazy behavior that looks completely different than what you started with. And that's essentially the kind of things that quantum mechanics can give you, just collective behavior, sometimes called emergent. You can have emergent degrees of freedom that appear due to strong quantum fluctuations that look very different than what you started with. Okay? So something that you may want to do is the following exercise. So first I'll tell you the slogan, then I'll try to explain it. So the first thing that I want to say is that conformal field theories induce an ordering in the space of quantum field theories. So let me try to flesh this out. I already said some words here now, but let me start here. So imagine I start with some conformal field theory. Let me call it 1. And now let me deform this theory by some relevant operator, okay? So similar to what I wrote there, so lambda O. This is relevant. As I said before, even if you knew how to solve completely CFT1, which is not the case unless the CFT1 is a free field theory, solving this theory with a perturbation is not tractable at large distances, because at large distances, lambda becomes large, and then I don't know what I'm doing. But now I go back to this statement that I made, which I think it was intuitive, that if you go to arbitrary large distances, you will get something that's scale invariant. So what we're going to get here in the flow to the infrared, so going this down means that now you go to the deep infrared. You're going to get a conformal field theory by statement number 1. Okay, so I start with a conformal field theory 1, and then I deform by a relevant operator, I go to conformal field theory 2. So now there is something you can say which is very powerful. And again, I'm saying that this theory here, I have no really clue how to compute using Feynman diagrams starting from here, because it's strongly coupled. And you have to many times guess what this answer is. I mean, there are lots of guesses in physics, smart guesses, so you have to guess a little bit this answer. So, and the way that you go from here to here is by, so essentially what you do is you have a renormalization group flow, you must have heard these words, from this theory perturbed by this relevant operator to this CFT2, okay? So essentially what happens is that, and I'm trying to explain in what sense conformal field theories provide an ordering in the space of quantum field theories. Essentially, what happens is that we can assign a height function, to just call it a name. To conformal field theories that have the following property, that have the property that. So here, let's call this UV, right? I started with some theory in the UV, and then I perturb and I go to the deep infrared. And let's call this quantity C. So C is this quantity that's a height function. We will see later why we call it C. Not today, but some other time. So we can assign a height function that has the following property, that C, the conformal field theory in the UV that you started with, is bigger than the C you can assign to the infrared CFT. So you have the ultraviolet CFT and you have the infrared CFT. The logic connection is that you can obtain in the infrared CFT by perturbing the ultraviolet CFT by an operator. Then you can prove that there is this quantity called C that is necessarily monotonically decreasing under RG flow, okay? So for example, this tells you already something very powerful. Imagine that you know how to compute, you have two CFTs and you know how to compute C in the two CFTs. And of course, one of them will be bigger than the other one. You can already prove that there is no perturbation of one CFT that will allow you to go to the other one, because you can only go in one direction. That's the statement that the normalization group flow is irreversible. So imagine that this is a correct RG flow, that you can go from this CFT to this CFT. This statement implies that it is impossible to go from CFT2 to CFT1. Because if this statement is correct, it tells you that the C of this guy is smaller than the C of this guy. So that's allowed. But that means that this is not allowed, because the C function has to decrease. And we already said that the C of this CFT is larger than this one. So this gives you very powerful constraints on this kind of hard non-perturbative problems of what is possible, what can arise given a deformation, what can arise in the infrared. It kind of gives a logical relation between different CFTs. You can only go from one to the other in one direction, not the other way around. Okay. And since CFTs are related to the space of to all massive theories in this way, this gives kind of literally a height function in the space of quantum field theories. It gives a logical relation of how you can connect one to the other by using deformations, okay? Yes?
So make the ordering on the whole space of QFTs, that implies that given the QFT, there's a unique or up to C value CFT, which is a deformation of, is that right?
So there can be more than one, given a massive theory, you can arrive to it in more than one way, but one description of it might be more weakly coupled.
So would the C values have to be the same?
The C value is only assigned to the extreme CFT. So you have a massive theory, and you can ask what happens in the deep infrared. You're going to get the CFT. You can only actually in certain dimensions you can assign a value C to the whole RG flow, including places where the theory is still massive and is still monotonically decreasing. But in general, the statement I'm making now is a weaker statement. I'm just making a statement about the asymptotics of the theories, the actual CFTs. But this already constraints. You have a very complicated space of all quantum field theories. You have like special points there, and you know the logical relation between the points. You know that there are very strong constraints by this. These things are called C theorems. It gives you essentially certainly a relation, a logical relation between all these theories. Okay. I could say so many things, but And one thing, okay, so and one thing that I want to mention is that DC quantity, at least in even dimensions. So obviously, we will be very interested in learning how to diagnose C, how to compute C, this quantity, in a conformal field theory, because it gives us extremely powerful information about the space of quantum field theories. So you may ask, what is the physical meaning? What is the physical meaning? Or how do I compute C in a conformal field theory? And we will come back to this. So how do we compute? And it turns out that the universal answer to this question is the following. Essentially, it is measured by doing something that looks weird, by computing the partition function of your CFT, not in a flat Minkowski space, but on the d-dimensional sphere. So if you are able, by some clever trick, to compute the partition function of your CFT on the d-dimensional sphere, from here you can extract C. This actually measures C. Okay. Now, this object that looks like I pulled out of thin air has a physical interpretation in a flat Minkowski space. So I'll just mention the buzzwords. We may come back to back later. These measures, and I believe you must have seen at least these buzzwords in other courses. These measures entanglement entropy. Of the vacuum state in Minkowski space. That's true in any dimension. So that's one interpretation of this in any dimension, space time dimension D. So the relevant ones will be 2, 3, 4, essentially, for us. But it turns out that for even dimensions, C is what's called a conformal anomaly. And that introduces yet another word that presumably you have not yet studied in detail, which is the word anomaly, which is again, a situation where a classical symmetry is violated quantum mechanically. Okay? But it's violated in a very specific way, and the way in which it is violated gives a strong constraints to the theory. Okay. So in one of the lectures later in the course, I will introduce you to the concept of anomalies, and in particular to the conformal anomaly. Okay. Okay. Very good. So now, so this was more kind of, if you wish, more high-flying conceptual reasons why conformal field theories are interesting. They obviously play, for by all these arguments, they play an important role in the space of field theories. Now I'm going to give you more, well, some more down-to-earth and some less down-to-earth reasons why CFTs are important.
I have a question.
Yes?
Can you still do compute this C, the function, if you're in not in Minkowski?
Well, yeah. So, for example, if you can extract C, either by correlation functions of the energy momentum. Okay, I'm telling you something, and we will discuss this later. So you can either measure C by correlation function of the energy momentum tensor in flat space, Minkowski space, or alternatively, and actually more easily, by computing the partition function of the CFT on the round sphere.
So for that, do you have to assume that you're doing a big rotation, right?
Yes, but yes. In conformal field theory, it's well established how to do a weak rotation from back and forth from Lorentzian to Euclidean. Yeah. Okay, so other examples is that other reasons, and actually these were the original reasons that people care about this, is that CFTs are directly relevant for nature. They describe phase transitions. So I'm sure you have seen this to a certain extent. Maybe not the language of CFT, but so in order to describe this, it might be useful to pick a particular example of a statistical mechanics system that's very important, that has a phase transition, a second order phase transition. So you can take the 3D Ising model. The Hamiltonian is something like this, so minus J, that's some just any energy factor, and you sum over all nearest neighbors the spins. So you have a three-dimensional lattice. I'll draw it too because I don't know how to draw three-dimensional lattices. And you have spins here, and essentially you sum over, you have a spin at its lattice side, and you have this energy function. Okay. Now it is known that this model has the following phase diagram. So you have J, you have a magnetic field. Okay, you have a critical temp. So can someone tell me what happens at very high temperatures in this model? So there's a quantity you can define in the three-dimensional. I mean, the Ising model is a model for a magnetism, right? So at very high temperatures, what is the magnetization? Is disordered? Okay, yes, but okay, the first thing to say is that this model has an obvious Z2 symmetry, where sigma I goes to minus sigma I. And if you go to very, very high temperatures, the system is disordered. And so you get a disordered state. The magnetization is zero. And in terms of symmetry, Z2 is unbroken. So the Hamiltonian has a certain symmetry. Now you want to know where, and that symmetry can be broken or unbroken by the vacuum state. In this case, it's unbroken. Okay. Now, what happens at very low temperatures in the Ising model? I mean, you have it's a magnet, right? So now M is non-zero. And depending on whether the magnetic field is slightly positive or negative, you get positive magnetization, so all spins are up, or negative magnetization where all spins are down. Okay? And this is the ordered state. Ordered because all spins are friendly and align the same way. And since since a particular configuration picks an orientation for the spins, the Z2 symmetry is spontaneously broken. So Z2 is broken. Now, what happens? And essentially now you can, in the ordered and disordered phase, you can study the following quantity. You can study the correlation function of spin at site I and spin at site j. You can measure sigma I, sigma j. And in the ordered and disordered phase, you have the spins are correlated in some way, okay? And exponentially so. Just like a massive field theory. So if you study a massive scalar field, the two-point function of a scalar field has exponential correlation functions. Right? And this quantity zeta is called the correlation length. And it tells you the length scale over which spins are correlated, essentially. Okay. Now, what happens in nature, in second-order phase transitions, is that if the experimentalist has a knob, and by tuning that knob, you can essentially bring the system to a situation where the correlation length goes to infinity. Okay, so that the spins are correlated at arbitrary large distances. Okay. And this is called a critical point. And the critical point, say here at the Curie temperature, okay, JC. Curie point is described precisely by a conformal field theory. Because now you have a situation in which the system has no longer a length scale, because the correlation length is infinite. There is no finite correlation length, and therefore the theory is described by a conformal field. So this is a very concrete example in which conformal field theories appear in nature. In essentially all second order and higher order phase transitions are governed by a conformal field theory. And one of the difficult tasks is to compute. So as you know, when you study that system, you have to study the thermodynamics, right? You have to understand how the magnetization, the heat capacity, all those awful things diverge as you approach the critical point. And those define what are called the critical exponents of your critical point. And the beautiful thing about this is the critical exponents that measure down-to-earth things like, as I said, the magnetization, the heat capacity, and so on. Are nothing but the scaling dimensions delta, which I introduced earlier, of operators in the conformal field theory. Okay. So that this abstract object that actually for the 3D Ising model is not a model that can really be solved by using Feynman diagrams, because in this, at this point, fluctuations are incredibly large. You can have any perturbative expansion breaks down. But we know abstractly from these arguments that there is a CFT living there. And one of the goals of these lectures will be to forget about Lagrangians and Hamiltonians like this and try to solve as much as we can of the theory here using the powerful constraints of conformal symmetry. So we're going to use conformal symmetry to essentially compute the critical exponents of the 3D Ising model that appears in nature. Okay? And this is very conceptually very different than the way you think about physics, you've done physics until now, which is that you start with a Lagrangian and you do perturbation theory. Here we're going to solve the system with we're never going to talk about the Lagrangian. We're just going to use symmetries and solve in quotes for the properties of the critical point. And as such, is a, I mean, this is just one example. There are many, many phase transitions in nature, and they're all governed by a conformal field theory. So this is kind of a very down-to-earth and important, I mean, way in which conformal field theories are relevant. In the lecture notes, I have more details about how the critical exponents are related to the scaling dimensions. You can read them later if you want. Okay. But of course, to hit the critical point here, one thing that's important is that they experimentally very carefully had to tune one parameter, namely the temperature, to hit this point, right? And that's typical of situations in nature. When, in order to get a conformal field theory in nature, some experimentalist has to tune the magnetic field or the pressure or the temperature or something to hit this special point. Okay. Okay. So this is an example of conformal field theories that describes phase transitions that are driven by thermal fluctuations. You can also have conformal field theories describing what are called quantum phase transitions. Which are driven not by thermal, so here the phase transition is driven by thermal fluctuations. Here they're driven by quantum fluctuations. So today, if you don't mind, I'll take a few more minutes because I want to finish this, and then tomorrow we can start whenever we start again with a clean slate. Okay. So these are transitions that happen at zero temperature. Okay. So these are the transitions that happen at non-zero temperature. These happen at zero temperature. And what are these? Essentially, these are transitions where you have a given Hamiltonian. You have a quantum Hamiltonian that depends on a parameter lambda. And you look at the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. So there is a ground state we call E0. And there is a first excited state, E1. Okay? And there is a gap. We call this the gap, delta of lambda. A quantum phase transition happens when the gap goes to zero as lambda approaches some critical value, lambda star, okay? Again, when you have this, so when there is a gap, there is an energy scale in the system, right? It's the distance from the ground state to the first excited state. When you go to the critical point, there is no length scale anymore because you have collapsed the gap, essentially. There is no gap anymore, okay? And the behavior of the system at this point is described by a conformal field theory. So let me give you an example of a system that you're presumably familiar with that has this behavior, which is the quantumizing model in one dimension. So you have spins on a line, i plus 1, i minus 1. So it has an energy function like that in a transverse magnetic field. So these are the polymatrices sigma z, and this is the polymatrix in the x direction. This is like a magnetic field term, right? It's like perpendicular magnetic field to this. And the point is that there exists a critical point at g equals 1. Okay. And actually, this is an example in which, since the theory is relatively simple, we know everything. So this implies that there is a CFT describing this critical behavior. This is a CFT that we can completely solve in all details. It's described by a two-dimensional conformal field theory. There are very special things that happen to conformal field theories in 1 plus 1 dimensions that allow us to solve even more than in higher dimensions. Certainly, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, we can completely solve CFTs, some CFTs. That's not the case in higher dimensions. And this CFT is a two-dimensional CFT that we know everything about, essentially. OK. And now I'll just finish with two more things. So these were kind of very down-to-earth situations in which conformal field theory appears. Conformal theories also appear in more theoretical work. So I'll just mention them briefly, because they in a sense, motivate large areas of research in theoretical physics. So it's my duty to report and give an unbiased opinion. So what's the point there? So 5, 6. So one example. Exactly, they're relevant to quantum gravity in two ways. So one is a collection of buzzwords that you may have heard about, but in which there is much more than buzzwords behind it, but that will be a separate course, and I believe you will have a separate course on it, which is ADS-CFT correspondence. That's probably the first time you heard the word CFT. So this is a statement essentially that there is a can of soup where inside the can you have gravity and outside you have a CFT. And everything that can happen inside the can is described by a CFT. Okay. So if you know how to solve this CFT, you know everything about quantum gravity inside that can. Okay. So that's an amazing statement in itself. It's shocking. I mean, it sounds like crazy that you can describe gravity by a non-gravity. CFTs have no gravity in them. There are no propagating gravitons or anything. That a theory that has no gravitational degrees of freedom can encode completely and non-perturbatively the physics of gravity in the box. Okay. So that's one situation. A more, in a sense, more from first principles point of view, how conformal field theories enter in quantum gravity is via string theory. So string theory is an example of a theory that tries to tell us what happens at very short distance scales. So everything is made out of little loops of string. And the physics of string theory is governed by a quantum field theory that lives on this two-dimensional. So you have a string, which is one-dimensional, and it makes a tube as it moves along space-time. So it's a 1 plus 1 dimensional. And string theory, in some way of saying it, is described by a two-dimensional quantum field theory. That lives on the string worldsheet. So, you know, you have strings moving in space-time, they interact and blah, blah, blah. So here, there is a certain dimensional, two-dimensional quantum field theory. Now, one of the amazing properties, and you will learn this from a string theory course if you take it, is that consistency really means that, otherwise it's bullshit, that the string theory requires that the two-dimensional quantum field theory that lives on the string worldsheet is actually a conformal field theory. So if it's not a conformal field theory, the theory is inconsistent. Okay? So conformal invariance miraculously emerges from consistency of string theory. Furthermore, you know all the wonderful equations that we wrote down before, like the Maxwell equation, the Young-Mills equation, the Dirac equation. So all the equations of motion that we know and love, so d mu, f mu, psi bar, okay, sorry, all of them follow, so all of them follow from demanding conformal invariance. So that's one of the amazing things about string theory, is that things that we knew from a macroscopic point of view, like Dirac equation, I mean, the Dirac equation was invented much before string theory, are a direct consequence of conformal invariance on the two-dimensional worldsheet of the string. Okay. And last but not least, and I should stop because I'm going over time, conformal field theories have very deep connection to mathematical physics. So there are whole areas of mathematics that kind of grew up out of the subject of conformal field theory that has to do with topology, enumerative geometry, many such things. Okay. So I think we should probably stop. And tomorrow we will start more systematically to develop the kinematics and geometry of conformal field theories.